everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on discovering the first galaxies right after this message. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor. And we're taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if your local plumber said, he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? What if your carpenter said that? He who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client. Now, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or steps is incompetent? Well, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who couldn't represent himself in court has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or carpenter. Now, listen to James Nielsen. Now, he's a professor of law at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he said about your local neighborhood lawyer. He said, it is a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. And it's worse than that, he said. Most students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. And a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, it's a cruel hoax. That's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedure is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, just go to the website georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? That's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, I picked up an old issue of the National Geographic. It's the February 2003 National Geographic magazine. And the lead article is called Discovering the First Galaxies. It's a 28-page article, 11 pages of text, and it is a high-powered article in a high-powered national magazine with worldwide circulation, and it explains to us the evolutionary philosophy, not science, but evolutionary philosophy in spades. And I thought I'd share it with you. Now, they don't talk to us in terms of theories and hypotheses. They talk to us in terms of accomplished, absolute, demonstrable, scientific fact. This is the way it is. This is where the bear does it, and this is where the rubber meets the road. No ifs, ands, or buts. This is the gospel, according to Caltech, the Mount Wilson Observatory, National Geographic, and they claim to speak the mind of God Himself. Science. This is science, they tell us. So I read the article, and when I got through reading the article, I said, if somebody came into a courtroom in the United States of America with this argument, they would be laughed out of the courtroom. And I'm going to show that to you as we progress along. I mean, if you walked in to any court in the United States of America under the rules of civil or criminal procedure, I don't care, take your pick, state or federal court, and walk in to make this argument, the judge would throw the case out. A motion for summary judgment would be carried immediately after the presentation. I mean, that's how poor this argument is. Now let's look at it from the point of view of the courts. And what can we prove, and what is it that is assumed, believed, taken as an article of faith? I mean, this is like a religion. I mean, you talk about religious fervor and religious belief. These guys have the religious people four ways to Sunday. Listen to this. Stories by Ron Cowan, C-O-W-E-N. Wonderful pictures. 28 pages of dramatic pictures from the Hubble telescope and of galaxies and spiral nebula and quasars. And I mean, you name it, and they've got pictures of it. Imagine a universe with no stars, no galaxies, and no light. Just a black brew of primordial gases immersed in a sea of invisible matter. Beginning a few hundred thousand years after the blinding flash of the Big Bang, the universe plunged into a darkness that lasted almost half a billion years. Then something happened that changed it all. Something that led to the creation not just of stars and galaxies, but also of planets, people, begonias, and lizards. What could that something have been? New clues to this puzzle, one of the most fundamental in cosmology, are pouring in from many directions. The theorists, using supercomputer simulations, have retraced the steps that produced the first stars and galaxies. Astronomers, peering through giant new telescopes, have journeyed back in time in search of the first galaxies. Researchers studying images from the Hubble Space Telescope have discovered the breathtaking diversity of the galaxies that surround us today, from giant pinwheels blazing with the blue light of newborn stars to misshapen footballs glowing with the ruddy hue of stars born billions of years ago, to tattered galaxies trailing long streamers of stars torn out by collisions with intruder galaxies. Less than a century ago, astronomers knew only about our own Milky Way galaxy, the Milky Way, which they believed then held about 100 million stars. Then, observers discovered that some of the fuzzy blobs in the sky weren't in our own galaxy, but they were galaxies in their own right. Collections of stars, gas, and dust bound together by gravity. Today we know that the Milky Way contains more than 100 billion stars, and that there are some 100 billion galaxies in the universe. Each one of these galaxies harbors an enormous number of stars. Our view of the universe is changing completely, says cosmologist Carlos Frank of the University of Durham in England, and it's largely because of our new understanding of galaxy formation. It's no exaggeration to say that we're going through a period of change analogous to the Copernican Revolution, whatever the Copernican Revolution was. One of the new cosmologists, Tom Abel of Pennsylvania State University, thinks that he has figured out how the first star was born. One afternoon last April, he sat by a hotel pool in Cozumel, Mexico, oblivious to the squawking blackbirds, and the whir of the poolside blender kept busy making pina coladas. He was staring intently at images on his laptop computer, images depicting how star formation could have happened. In a few minutes, he would go back inside the hotel to share the images with his colleagues at one of the largest meetings ever devoted to the origin of galaxies. Now, the first star was born about 14 billion years ago, Abel believes, in a universe that was more mysterious, but also far simpler than our own. Smaller and denser than today, the universe was pitch black and contained mostly hydrogen and helium with a smattering of lithium. During the past few years, together with his colleagues, Michael L. Norman of the University of California at San Diego and Greg L. Bryan of Oxford University, Abel has created supercomputer simulations that show how stars were formed from these gases. The first step, according to the simulations, was when gravity gathered gases into diffuse clouds, and as the gases cooled, they coalesced at the center of each cloud into a clump no larger than our sun. That clump collapsed further while surrounding gas piled on top of it. In this way, it grew into a behemoth about 100 times the mass of our sun. Finally, several million years after the entire process began, the intense compression forged a full-fledged star, and there was light. Elsewhere, the same star-forming process had begun in other gas clouds that Abel refers to as microgalaxies, miniature, single-starred versions of today's galaxies. Soon, beacons of light from massive stars permeated the darkness. These stars burned brightly and then fizzled after only a few million years, dying in titanic explosions called supernova. During the brief time that these first stars reigned, however, they wrought changes in the universe that had a profound effect on future galaxy formation. They heated surrounding gases and bombarded them with ultraviolet light, and when they exploded, the stars seeded the universe and the next generation of stars with the first supply of heavy elements, including the oxygen that we breathe today. The explosive demise of these stars may have left behind dense cinders, the first black holes of the universe. Moreover, the supernova explosions may have been accompanied by flashes of energetic radiation known as gamma ray bursts that are billions of times brighter than the sun. If so, some of the gamma ray bursts that have already been detected may actually have come from the first stars. It would be the most wonderful thing, said Abel, if we were so lucky that the first stars that were formed were also the brightest. Abel's presentation in Cozumel was a great success. Scientists consider his simulations the most convincing scenario yet discovered for how stars were born. The simulations are based on a mind-blowing concept, some kind of mystery material which cannot be seen and has come to be known as dark matter, outweighs all of the visible material in the universe by at least 9 to 1. Galaxies are merely bright flecks on a sea of dark matter. Without the extra tug provided by dark matter, astronomers tell us, there wouldn't be enough gravity to pull material into galaxy-sized clumps or even to form the first star. The concept of dark matter has been around for many decades, but cosmologists were slow to embrace it. That might have been because one of the first people to suggest the dark matter theory was a brilliant but abrasive genius named Fritz Zwicky, born in 1898. Zwicky's personality didn't encourage a fan club. He once called his colleagues at the Mount Wilson Observatory spherical bastards because he said they were bastards any way you looked at them. In 1933, Zwicky turned his attention to a nearby cluster of galaxies called the Coma Cluster, and he realized that the Coma Cluster simply shouldn't exist. And that's because individual galaxies in Coma were zipping around so fast that the gravity exerted by the visible parts of the cluster was too puny to keep Coma intact. So Zwicky had a solution. He proposed that all of the visible material in the cluster was a mere fill-up. The rest, which he could not see, he simply dubbed dark matter. Well, no one wanted to believe crazy Fritz was right. Decades later, resistance to Zwicky's ideas began to fade when astronomers found themselves involving and invoking dark matter to explain a host of puzzles. Well, in 1973, Princeton cosmologists Jim Peebles and Jerry Ostreicher said the mystery material was necessary to keep spiral galaxies, including our own Milky Way, from falling apart. A few years later, Vera Rubin of the Carnegie Institution of Washington concluded that spiral galaxies she and her colleagues had examined had to be embedded in a halo of dark matter. That was the only way to explain, she said, why stars at the outer edge of the spiral galaxies moved no more slowly than the stars at the core. Dark matter, moreover, answered a key riddle, a riddle of galaxy formation, how the universe changed from a smooth, hot soup of particles into a jumble of galaxies and galaxy clusters. There had to be some lumps in the first place. By itself, ordinary matter, protons, electrons, and neutrons, couldn't provide those lumps. There wasn't enough of it. And it couldn't begin clumping until the universe had cooled. Dark matter, by contrast, was plentiful and all but impervious to every force but gravity. It could coalesce almost immediately after the universe's birth, giving ordinary matter a foothold to form galaxies, even as cosmic expansion tried to pull them apart. Evidence backing up the lumpy soup theory came in 1992 when a NASA satellite called the Cosmic Background Explorer detected tiny hot and cold spots out in space. This supported the idea that the seeds of galaxy formation, the primordial lumps in the early universe created by dark matter, they left tiny temperature variations in the cosmic microwave background, now cooled to a frigid 2.73 degrees above absolute zero. Famed cosmologist Stephen Hawking pronounced the finding of the discovery of the century, if not of all time. Edwin Hubble set the stage for today's studies of galaxy formation when he discovered that the Milky Way galaxy was not alone. In the pre-dawn hours of October the 6th, 1923, at the Mount Wilson Observatory in California, Hubble photographed a fuzzy spiral-shaped clump of stars known as M31, or Andromeda, which most astronomers assumed was part of the Milky Way. Hubble soon realized that within the clump that he had found a tiny jewel. It was a star known as Cepheid, a Cepheid variable. This type of star has a wonderful property. Its brightness waxes and wanes like clockwork, and the longer it takes to vary, the greater the star's intrinsic brightness. That means the star can be used to measure cosmic distances. By comparing the true brightness of the Cepheid in M31 with its brightness as it appears in the sky, Hubble was able to determine the distance between Earth and the star. He discovered that the star and the cloud or nebula in which it resided were 1,000,000 light years away, 3 times the estimated diameter of the entire universe. Clearly, this clump of stars resided far beyond the confines of the Milky Way. But if Andromeda was a separate galaxy, then maybe many of the other nebula in the sky were galaxies as well. The known universe suddenly ballooned in size. Hubble soon recognized that galaxies come in 3 varieties. Ellipticals, which converted most of their gas into stars long ago, and they resemble distorted footballs. Then there are spiral galaxies, including our own Milky Way. They account for 2/3 of the known galaxies in the universe. These galaxies have central bulges of old stars, just like an elliptical, but their cores are surrounded by disks containing slender spiral arms still aglow with newborn stars. Our nearest spiral neighbor, Andromeda, resembles a frisbee with a fried egg at its center. Finally, irregular galaxies are the plodders, apparently making stars at the same slow rate ever since they were born. This diversity of galaxies is rooted in violence, according to Julio Navarro of the University of Victoria in British Columbia. Like Abel, Navarro relies on computer simulations to study galaxy evolution, but his work focuses on galaxies later in their life cycles when they're prone to smash into each other and are chock full of stars. Recent studies by Navarro and Matthias Steinmetz of the Astrophysical Institute in Potsdam, Germany, depict how collisions could have altered the appearance of a single galaxy as it made its way through some 12 billion years of cosmic history. Now, the first galaxy was a disk, Navarro believes, a consequence of the object's rapid rotation and the pull of gravity. As this disk repeatedly ran into and fused with other baby galaxies, the orbits of its stars became scrambled. The battered disk puffed into a swirling, sparkly ball of gas and stars, an elliptical galaxy. Then, as the galaxy slowly dragged in streamers of gas, the ball became the aging centerpiece of a bigger disk with spiral arms. Another collision erased that structure and created a larger ball. With each collision, the galaxy altered its shape, like a lump of clay constantly being resculpted, but also growing larger and larger with each collision. The most popular version of the dark matter theory says that galaxies began small and grew over time through collisions and slow accumulation of material from their surroundings. And these collisions weren't just things of the past, Navarro notes. Witness the Antenna galaxies, 2 galaxies caught in a cosmic tussle 63 million light years from Earth. Their mutual gravity has pulled out two long streamers of luminous matter that resembles the antennae of a cockroach. Now, closer to home, the Andromeda Galaxy, now hurtling toward us at 300,000 miles an hour, will merge with the Milky Way in several billion years, theorists predict. Now, it wasn't the orderly shapes of mature galaxies, but the messy shapes of baby galaxies that captured the imagination of astronomer Chuck Steidel at the California Institute of Technology. His work has led to the discovery of more than 2,000 early galaxies, sometimes at a rate of 100 a night, providing important data for theorists like Abel and Navarro. And it all began with a trek to a remote mountaintop in Hawaii. As Steidel and three of his closest colleagues drove slowly up the narrow, bumpy road to the 13,700-foot summit of Mauna Kea, they knew this was their chance to crack open the secrets of the early universe. In the skies, or if the skies remained clear, they were about to observe the heavens with the largest visible light telescope in the world, the Keck telescope. It was September 30th, 1995, and Steidel, at only 32, hoped to accomplish what no one had ever done before: detect in wholesale numbers galaxies so distant that the light that they emitted more than 12 billion years ago was only now reaching the Earth. That meant that the galaxies would appear as they did when they were infants. If Steidel and his collaborators could find enough of them, these youngsters might reveal not only how galaxies first formed, but also how they changed over time and how they were distributed across the universe. Well, until then, astronomers hunting distant galaxies hadn't made very much progress. They had found a few oddball objects that glowed extremely brightly, but they had failed to find the run-of-the-mill, the remote galaxies thought to be prevalent in the cosmos. Most astronomers figured that they would need bigger telescopes to find these faint objects, but Steidel had another idea. Maybe galaxies that hailed from the early universe had already been detected, but no one had been able to pick them out from the thousands of other objects on sky maps. And, like a few other astronomers before him, Steidel realized that distant galaxies have their own signposts. They contain an abundance of hydrogen gas, as does the vast expanse of intergalactic space between them and the Earth. When the ultraviolet light emitted by stars in galaxies becomes or gets above a certain energy level, hydrogen gas absorbs it. That light never reaches the Earth. So before Steidel and his collaborators ever dreamed of coming to Keck, they recorded galaxies that showed up brightly in red and green filters, but were absent when viewed through ultraviolet filters. They called these galaxies Lyman Break galaxies, after Theodore Lyman. Lyman was a physicist who pioneered studies of ultraviolet light in the early 20th century. Now, according to the color criterion, the faint galaxies Steidel's team had found prior to coming to Mauna Kea sought to be or ought to be remote. But were they really remote? To measure distance, the astronomers had to determine how much light from a galaxy had been stretched or reddened by the expansion of the universe. The greater this red shift, the greater the distance from Earth. So a galaxy at a red shift of 3, for instance, corresponds to a distance of about 12 billion light years. For faint galaxies, redshift can only be determined with a telescope as powerful as Keck. Now, Steidel and his colleagues, Mark Dickinson, Mauro Giavellisco, and student Kurt Adelberger, found themselves with two nights on the telescope. If they could demonstrate that their color method worked, they'd have a foolproof way to find not just one or two distant galaxies, but dozens of galaxies, even hundreds of galaxies. Now, years before, Steidel and his collaborators had already picked out their first target. Residing in the constellation of Eridanus, it was the brightest Lyman Break galaxy that the team had yet found. We figured that if we were going to be successful, it was going to be with this object, Steidel recalls, but he also knew that from Mauna Kea, the starlit body rose above the horizon for only an hour each night. What a story, isn't it? I mean, this is almost like reading a story before bedtime. Well, hang on. We'll take a break here, give you a message, and we'll be back with more on discovering the first galaxies when we come back. Now, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. Well, those who already walk submissively will say that there's no cause for alarm, but submissiveness is not our heritage. The First Amendment was designed to allow rebellion to remain as our heritage. The Constitution was designed to keep government off the backs of the people, and the Bill of Rights was added to keep the precincts of belief and expression of the press, of political and social activities, free from government surveillance. Now, you know, I wished I'd have thought of that, but that quotation comes from Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas. Now, our princes and our politicians beller in the halls of Congress for more taxes, more spending, more gun control. But you and I haven't heard anything intelligent come out of a politician's mouth in more than 75 years. That's why I contend that the only real reason, logic, or common sense left in America comes from our courts, not from our political process. It certainly doesn't come from our politicians, lawyers, or bureaucrats. Now, old Mayor Rothschild summed it up with a flair when he said, "You give me the money power, and I care not who makes the laws." Well, let me echo that by saying that you give me the judicial power and I care not who makes the laws either, because the real power in America is in our courts, not in our political process. Now, if you'd like to tap into that power of the courts, why don't you call the law school at area code 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for the free general law CD package. Now, that's a 4-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Now, Courtroom Strategy and Procedure, the school is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, go to the website, georgegordon.org, click on to the email, and then send an email request for that free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? That's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Tonight's report, Discovering the First Galaxies, being taken from the February 2003 issue of the National Geographic magazine. Well, the fleeting hour that the Keck Astronomical Observatory stared at the galaxy, however, turned out to be enough. Just as Steidel had predicted, the spectrum revealed that the galaxy resided 12 billion light years from Earth. Steidel was thrilled that his technique could find an ordinary galaxy so far away. On the next night at Mauna Kea, the astronomers attempted an even more ambitious feat. Taking full advantage of the power of the Keck telescope and the Keck spectrograph, They attempted to measure the distance simultaneously to several galaxies in the same patch of sky. To do so, they used a mask, a piece of aluminum about the size of a cookie sheet, which had several narrow slits carefully cut out, each slit precisely aligned with the position of a target galaxy. Now, with the mask in place, only the light from each target galaxy could enter Keck's spectrograph. By the end of that night, these young astronomers had found 15 galaxies with redshifts greater than 3. On that night, slightly giddy from the high altitude, Seidel played for the first time at Keck the dreamy lullaby-like music of the alternative rock band Maisie Star. It would soon become a coda for each night Seidel observed at Keck, and a special bond between him and Dickinson, whom he had met when they were both college disc jockeys at Princeton back in 1980. By 1997, Steidel's team had bagged another 250 Lyman Break galaxies, and an intriguing pattern emerged. To the surprise of astronomers, whose distant galaxies were strongly clustered in a way that revealed how dark matter is distributed, the first galaxies formed in the densest regions of the universe, which correspond on average with the densest regions of the cosmos today, where we find large galaxy groups and clusters as time went on and gravity exerted its inexorable pull. Regions of lower density also gave birth to galaxies blazing with newborn stars. Just as important was another discovery made by Steidel and Kurt Adelberger back in 2001. Powerful winds were rushing out of the Lyman Break galaxies, proving that there was more to the story of galaxy formation than dark matter. The winds, driven by supernova explosions, were so strong they enabled ordinary matter to temporarily escape the grasp of the dark matter, which was unaffected by the winds. Not only did the winds clear out a vast bubble around their home galaxy, they carried hydrogen and other elements into surrounding space. The heavy elements, which could only have been forged inside stars, set the stage for future generations of galaxies. For a few weeks, I dreamed about winds, and I thought about winds while I was eating my cereal in the morning, and while I was in the shower, and while I was rollerblading to work, says Adelberger, who is now at Harvard. These winds added a layer of complexity to the story of how galaxies evolved from the simple universe of dark matter and elemental gases described by Tom Abel. Without such winds, we can't easily explain the appearance of the visible universe today. Beginning where Steidel's team left off, astronomer Sandra Faber of the University of California at Santa Cruz is poised to break new ground. In the study of galaxy formation, she and her collaborators hope to piece together how baby galaxies like the ones found by Steidel developed into the galaxies around us today. Last March, wearing a navy blue jumpsuit that made her look more like an automobile mechanic than a surveyor of the heavens, Faber strode through the chilly rooms of the Keck 2 observatory, which began operation back in 1996, next to the first telescope. Now, she had come to Mauna Kea to install a state-of-the-art deep imaging multi-object spectrograph. It's called DEIMOS, D-E-I-M-O-S. And she and her team had designed DEIMOS. The 20,000-pound device, which was to be slid in and out of position on metal tracks, can simultaneously analyze the light from as many as 130 distant galaxies at the same time. "We're collecting the photo album of the life history of the universe for the first time," she said. "The baby pictures, the teenage pictures, the grown-up pictures. Astronomers are even taking snapshots of what the universe looked like before galaxies were born. If we used the birth of galaxies as our reference point," she said, "then the hot and cold spots in the cosmic microwave background would be prenatal pictures." Faber is homing in on the process of galaxy formation from mid-childhood to early adulthood. At a redshift 3, galaxies were blobby and irregular. At redshift 1, corresponding to a time when the universe was little more than half its current age, the shapes of galaxies cataloged by Edwin Hubble are beginning to fall into place. In between is a mystery interval from 12 to 8 billion years ago, in which galaxies are notoriously hard to detect. During this largely uncharted interval, galaxies matured, taking on their final mass and their familiar shapes. A goal of Deimos is to open this internal interval to view. "The spectrum of the night sky is the great enemy," she said, "an incredible picket fence of glowing emission lines, the bright light emitted by atoms and molecules at sharply defined wavelengths. This picket fence in Earth's atmosphere overwhelms the faint infrared light from galaxies that her team wants to study. There is one saving grace, however, and that is the emission lines are narrow, while those from distant galaxies are much broader. With that in mind, the Faber's team designed Deimos to greatly expand or disperse the infrared spectrum. That enables the team to look between the pickets and to focus on the light emitted by the galaxies." That's when the fun begins. The brightness and shapes of the galaxies at different redshifts and the myriad other properties that can be observed, thanks to Deimos, can now indicate how the small, scruffy-looking galaxies in the early universe formed the familiar galaxies that Hubble described clear back in the 1920s. Perhaps the most important of these properties is mass, so said Faber. "By measuring the mass of galaxies observed at different times in the universe, Faber hopes to trace the steps by which these galaxies merge and grow larger. She would also like to learn why spiral galaxies, which are easily disturbed by collisions, are so abundant. The answer could be that in recent times, spirals have grown by slowly drawing in material rather than through collisions." If her reasoning is correct, spiral galaxies should be forming stars at a gentle rate rather than in bursts that accompany collisions. Over the next few years, Deimos should provide the answer. A few hours after Faber finished her work for the day, the domes of the twin Keck telescopes slid open and the instruments drank in the faint light from some of the most distant objects in the heavens. Down in Waima, 48 miles away, two groups of astronomers were gathered inside of an industrial-style, low-rise building to relay instructions to operators on the mountain. Since 1996, a year after Steitel began his work, the telescopes have been directed from control rooms in this building, nearly 50 miles away. In one room, Arjun Day of the National Optical Astronomy Observatory in Tucson, Arizona, Daniel Stern of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, veteran observer, High Spinrad of the University of California, Berkeley, and graduate student Steve Dawson were aiming the Keck 1 telescope at a catalog of faint galaxies, hoping to peer deeper and deeper than ever before into the universe. A billion years further back in time than the galaxies found by Steidel. These were galaxies that grow brightest when they are observed through filters that allow only certain wavelengths of light to pass. The wavelengths correspond to a specific ultraviolet radiation emitted by hydrogen atoms that has been highly redshifted by the expansion of the universe. The filtered light was an indication, but not a confirmation, that the galaxies were located near the edge of the visible universe. In the control room next door, meanwhile, Caltech astronomer George Jorgovsky was also studying the distant universe using Keck 2. He was trying to take the spectra of one of the most distant known quasars, the brilliant beacons that emanate from the cores of some galaxies. This quasar was so far away that to reach Earth, its light pierced regions so far back in time that they hadn't yet been blasted by radiation from the first generation of stars to be born in the universe. Back at the Keck 1 control room, Day and his colleagues were staring at a bunch of squiggly black lines on the computer screen. After several hours of analysis, they came to a consensus. At a redshift of 5.74, the light that had fallen on the Keck telescope had left a galaxy known as Lala, J14-2546.76 plus 3520-36.3, more than 13 billion years ago. It appeared that they had found the third most distant galaxy known. But after a final check, Day and his collaborators smiled even more broadly and gave each other high fives, for on this night, March 13th, 2002, the astronomers had found the second most distant galaxy known in the universe, after another galaxy discovered at Keck with a redshift of 6.56. So what does all of this mean? Have astronomers finally solved the riddle of how galaxies were born and evolved? Well, not quite, says William C. Keel of the University of Alabama. But astronomers are likely to put pieces of the puzzle together over the next decade. With mammoth new maps of the nearby cosmos, scientists today can study 13 billion years of galaxy evolution. But a veil still conceals what happened during the first crucial period of galaxy formation, which astronomers have dubbed the Dark Ages. It began a few hundred thousand years after the Big Bang and ended perhaps a billion years later. During the first chunk of that time, the universe was truly dark, but later on, the first glimmers of starlight emerged with a telescope that has enough light gathering power and is sensitive to just the right wavelengths, and it should be able to detect them. A key task already begun will be to build a telescope to penetrate the veil. Keel and many astronomers are pinning their hopes on NASA's James Webb Space Telescope, the proposed successor to the Hubble Space Telescope, scheduled for launch about 2010. Equipped with a mirror capable of collecting six times as much light as Hubble, the telescope, with its advanced infrared and visible light instruments, will be able to detect objects much dimmer and much farther away than those observed by any other telescope. That should give scientists the power for the first time to peer into the Dark Ages and to record the faint, warm light from some of the very first stars and galaxies, objects that can now only be seen in computer simulations, like those on Tom Abel's laptop. Until then, the final frontier of galaxy formation awaits us, out in the darkness. Well, there's the 11-page text of the article called Discovering the First Galaxies. Boy, that sounds authoritative, doesn't it? I mean, these scientists, these cosmologists, these astronomers really have the bull by the horns now, don't they? Well, at least that's what they'd have us believe. Now, this entire story is science fiction. There are only three scientific statements in the entire article. The entire article is based upon hypotheses and theories and computer simulations, like a computer simulation of the Titanic. Do you remember the movie Titanic with its wonderful computer simulations? I mean, it was like riding on the ship. And when it hit the iceberg with these computer simulations and the ship broke in half, I mean, it was wonderful. Is a computer simulation science or science fiction? I mean, you know, I don't want to get in the way of people's happiness and success and their beliefs. But, you know, truth and facts are on one side of the equation, and supposition and theories and hypotheses are on the other side. When we come into court, we have what's called the rules of evidence. There are 188 rules of evidence that have evolved over, I'd say 1,000 or 2,000 years of time. You know, rules like the hearsay rule. When somebody comes in and they say, well, Bob told Bill, who told Sally, who told Hank, who told me, that here's what he saw. We call that hearsay, and we don't allow that in. Why don't we allow it in? Because it's unreliable. That's why. Now, there are 42 objections, 32 standard objections, and 10 hearsay exceptions. So we have 42 objections, and these 42 objections regulate the 188 rules of evidence. So that when we come into the courtroom, I have a burden, and my burden is to prove to you. This is what we call the burden of proof, the burden of going forward. And I have to make a presentation. My presentation has to have names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence. I have to be able to provide witnesses who can testify as to what they saw, what they heard, and what they know. Not what they think, or what they heard, or what somebody told them, or what we guess or we believe. It's got to be demonstrable. Now, science, by its very definition, just look it up in the dictionary. Science is knowledge. Now, knowledge is real, discernible fact. It's something that we know. It's something that is observable, that is reproducible, that you can do it over and over again. That's what science is all about. This is not science. This is science fiction, which goes under the guise of science. It's philosophy is what it is. It's religion at its core. Now, I'm not opposed to religion, but you don't see anybody presenting Genesis 1, 2, and 3 in the National Geographic magazine and making the presentation based upon names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence. And I intend to show in my presentation that Genesis 1, 2, and 3 is 100% scientific, true, accurate, correct, demonstrable, and can be proven. But there's nothing in this article save for three scientific statements: redshift, space and time, and spectrographic analysis, which is duplicatable. which is real science. So we have three basic scientific facts, and we've made a 28-page article with 11 pages of text in total science fiction. And we're supposed to believe this crap. Can you believe it? Published in the National Geographic magazine. Listen to just a few of these. I've got a couple of minutes. It says it could well be. Listen to some of these statements. It says, new clues to this puzzle. Can you imagine coming into court and saying, this guy is a murderer and we have new clues to this puzzle? The theorists using supercomputer simulations. I have a supercomputer simulation of how the murder could have occurred. How the Titanic could have sunk. How the Titanic could have hit the iceberg. Not what do we know, what do we have scientific, absolute, irrefutable proof of, but we have simulations. Now, excuse me, boys and girls. When I was a kid, we used to call this trick photography. That's where you'd watch this movie and you'd say, wow, did you see the Dukes of Hazzard with that car? Why that car flew through the air 4 miles and landed right side up. Well, yeah, you can do things like that in the movies. You can do that with computer simulation. But that isn't the way it works out in the real world, boys and girls. That isn't something that you can duplicate in the laboratory. That isn't something that you can see, hear, taste, touch, or smell. The guy takes his computer and he enters the program and he says, here's my preconceived idea. Here's what I want to prove. Here's what I believe. And he programs that into the computer. Then he plays it back for you and says, see? Just exactly the way we envisioned it. Well, how in the hell can you miss? If you program it in, isn't it going to play back just exactly the way you had anticipated that it would turn out? You know, boys and girls, that's a far cry from the way the real world works. That's why I said, if you took this crap into a courtroom, you'd be dismissed out on a summary judgment motion, for crying out loud. There isn't anything in here that can meet the tests of proof. They actually say so. So what does it all mean? After we've read 11 pages of text, what does it all mean? Have astronomers finally solved the riddle of how galaxies were born and evolved? Well, not quite, says William C. Keel of the University of Alabama. But astronomers are likely to put pieces of the puzzle together over the next decade. Can you imagine a prosecutor saying, so what does all of this evidence mean that you have presented, sir? Does it mean that you've proven that this guy is guilty of murder? Well, not quite. But we hope that it's likely that we can put the pieces of this puzzle together over the next decade. Oh, for crying out loud, give me a break, would you? Yeah, I'm out of time. We'll be back and we'll take this up again next time. Taking a look at discovering the first galaxies. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, for more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, I got to leave it right there. We're just about out of time. There's my signal. It says I got to leave it. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.